feeling cold with the breeze and highs of 3. On to our areas for Scotland now, where we've got a few wintry showers during the morning for northern and eastern Scotland, but throughout much of the day is going to be dry and bright with plenty of sunshine, a chilly breeze and highs of 3 to 4 degrees. That's the forecast.
Thanks a lot, Nina. Now on BBC Radio 4, we conclude our Book of the Week, Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan by William Dalrymple. By the end of 1841, Afghanistan has risen up against the British invasion and the reign of the puppet king Shah Shuja. The British envoy, William Macnaghten, has been murdered after arranging with the rebel leader Akbar Khan the safe retreat of the British from Kabul back to India. But the omens are not good. The reader is Tim Pigott-Smith.
Seen through the jagged new gap in the curtain wall, the sun rising over the ring of dazzling white mountains around Kabul revealed a day that was beautifully clear and frosty, with the snow nearly a foot deep on the ground. Yet the troops, waiting to march out of the relative safety of the cantonment walls to an uncertain fate in the Afghan mountains, were a less inspiring sight. A crouching, drooping, dispirited army, so different from the smart, light-hearted body of men they appeared some time ago, thought a depressed George Lawrence, military secretary to Macnaghten. My heart sunk within me under the conviction that we were a doomed force. To make matters worse, the Afghans, who had out-soldiered and outwitted the British, turned out not to be the crack troops from the mountains they had imagined them to be, but, in part at least, merely the tradesmen and artisans of Kabul, so that we had not even the melancholy satisfaction of knowing that we had been contending with the soldier tribes of the country, wrote Lawrence. Most harrowing of all was the knowledge that all the Afghans who still had any contact with the British were completely certain that the garrison were walking into a trap. No one did more to warn the British of the fate that awaited them in the passes than Shah Shuja himself. According to the Shah's biographer, Herati, he wrote to the British, "To leave the cantonment in the depths of this harsh winter is an act of extreme folly. Do not think of going to Jalalabad. Come and spend the winter with us in the Bala Hisar fort, where we will await the end of winter together." But this offer was not accepted. As the British buckled, ignoring Shuja's warnings, the Shah held out in the Bala Hisar. In the spring of the following year, despairing of being rescued by the British, he tried to get to Jalalabad, but was assassinated by his own godson, just outside the fort. At 9 a.m., on the morning of the 6th of January, 1842, to the sound of bugles and drums, the first British troops marched out of the cantonment and trudged off through the knee-high snow towards the Khord Kabul Pass on the Jalalabad Road. Lady Sale's final breakfast was cooked using the wood of her dining room table. She then donned the turban, an Afghan sheepskin pashteen that her Afghan friends had advised her to wear, declined Captain Lawrence's offer of protection, and chose to travel instead, mixed up with the brightly dressed troopers of the advance guard. There was no sign of the escort that the chiefs had promised to send with the British, nor was the hastily constructed pontoon bridge over the icy Kabul River ready, and they had to queue for an hour to make the crossing. Just after 11, when a long and vulnerable line of troops were standing waiting in the cold snow between the river and the cantonment, a swarm of Afghans began to descend from the village of Bibi Maru, rending the air with their exulting cries, and set about looting and burning the now deserted mission compound. An hour later, around noon, the Ghazis began to fire down into the waiting troops. By 1 o'clock, 50 of the European infantry were lying dead or wounded in the snow. As the Ghazis' rifles found their range, the camp followers and the last troops of the rearguard began to fall where they stood, first jostling, then fighting in panic for their turn to cross. As the fire from the ramparts increased in accuracy and intensity, tents, barrels of gunpowder, boxes of musket balls, packs of clothing and food were all abandoned in great piles on the banks of the Kabul River. The temperature dropped ever lower after sunset. At the camp in Bagrami that night, chaos ruled. Only a lucky few had anything to eat. George Lawrence succeeded in finding a little cold meat and sherry, which he was given by Lady McNaughton, who had brought her own supplies. Bengali sepoys had no idea how to cope in the snow, a sharp contrast to Mackenzie's loyal Afghan jazailchis, who showed how it could be done. Their first step on reaching the camping ground was to clear a small space from the snow, recalled an impressed Captain Vincent Eyre. They then laid themselves down in a circle, closely packed together, with their feet meeting in the centre, all the warm clothing they could muster among them being spread equally over the whole. By these simple means, sufficient animal warmth was generated to preserve them from being frostbitten. The second day of the retreat proved even more chaotic than the first. The remaining baggage had not even been lifted onto the camels and oxen before large numbers of Afghans began to dart down the mountain slopes, plundering all that they could lay their hands on. As the troops advanced on their road, the number of mounted Afghans around them steadily increased. They travelled parallel to the British, like shepherds expertly controlling a flock of panicked sheep. The terrified sepoys having already lost all will to fight back. One entire Hindustani regiment went over en masse to Akbar Khan that morning. Many other sepoys, already too frostbitten to continue, now threw down their weapons and fled back to Kabul. Months later, several hundred maimed former sepoys were still to be seen hobbling on their stumps, begging around the Kabul bazaars. For a second night, the troops again went to bed hungry in the thick snow. Just before sunrise, large numbers of Afghans had massed in the darkness to the rear of the British camp. "The scene at sunrise was fearful," wrote Hugh Johnson, the British paymaster. "The force was perfectly disorganized. Every man appeared to be so paralyzed with cold as to be scarcely able to hold his musket or move a step." The frontmost troops and followers were skilfully herded into the mouth of the Khord Kabul Pass, the women led by Lady Sale. "I felt very grateful for a tumbler of sherry, which at any other time would have made me feel most unladylike. We had not proceeded half a mile when we were heavily fired upon. I had fortunately only one ball in my wrist. Three others passed through my pushteen near the shoulder without doing me injury. 500 of our regular troops and about 2,500 of our camp followers are killed." On the fourth morning of the retreat, the 9th of January, in the middle of a high-altitude sub-zero blizzard, desperation finally gave way to complete despair. "The flesh from men's feet was peeling off in flakes," recorded Captain William Anderson, one of the last survivors of Shah Shuja's contingent. Scores had been frozen to death in the night. That evening, it was effectively acknowledged that the troops were doomed, and all the British women, or at least those of officer class, were given over into the hands of Akbar Khan. For those still on the retreat, however, the horrors continued. By the following morning, the 10th of January, after a second night on the exposed heights of the Khord Kabul, Hugh Johnson recorded succinctly that "we had now not a single sepoy remaining. We all gave ourselves up for lost." There followed the worst day of the retreat yet, as the snow-blinded and frostbitten troops stumbled through the narrows of the Tazeen Pass, where a second, meticulously laid ambush awaited them. "This was a terrible march," Dr. William Bryden recorded in his diary. "I often felt so blind myself that from time to time I applied a handful of snow to my eyes and recommended others to do so, as it gave great relief. By the evening of the 11th of January, after yet another day-long massacre, the ever-diminishing column stumbled out of the Tazeen Pass towards the fertile valley-bottom village of Jugdalak. By 9 the following night, most of the survivors, now almost maddened with hunger and especially with thirst, decided that their only hope was to press on in the dark. They found, however, their way blocked by a formidable thorny barrier of prickly hollyoak, well twisted together about 6 feet high. Those who tried to tear it down with their bare hands or claw their way up it were shot down as they did so. One of the very few to make it over the holly barrier was Dr. Bryden. He was saved by clinging to the stirrup of an officer's horse, and so was dragged clear of the melee. The least lucky were those hundreds of sepoys and camp followers, who neither escaped nor were enslaved or killed. In the Tazeen Pass alone, 1,500 of these were stripped of their goods and their clothes by the Afghans, then left to starve and freeze to death in the snows, abandoned by their British employers and treated with contempt by their Afghan captors. Dr. Bryden was eventually spotted by an eagle-eyed staff officer on the top turret of the Jalalabad fort, and rescuers quickly came to his assistance. That night, lamps were raised on the gates of Jalalabad and bugles blown to guide in any last stragglers. But none limped in. A strong wind was blowing from the south, remembered Captain Seaton, which sent the sound of the bugles all over the town. The terrible wailing sound of those bugles I will never forget. It was a dirge for our slaughtered soldiers. In time, the legend grew that the entire British army in Afghanistan had been wiped out. The story was immediately retold by Afghan poets and singers. It is said that 60,000 English troops went to Afghanistan, wrote Mirza Atta, and only a handful came back alive, wounded and destitute. The English love gold and money so much that they cannot stop themselves from laying their hands on any area productive of wealth. But what prize did they find in Afghanistan, except, on the one hand, the exhausting of their treasury, and on the other, the disgracing of their army? Many were taken captive en route. Many remained as cripples and beggars in Kabul, and the rest perished in the mountains, like a ship sunk without trace. For it is no easy thing to invade or govern the kingdom of Khorasan.
Only 30 years after the end of the First Afghan War, Britain found itself poised to invade the country once again. A survivor, George Lawrence, felt compelled to write to the Times. "A new generation has arisen," he wrote, "which is willing and eager to embroil us again in the affairs of that unhappy country. The retreat from Kabul should stand forever as a warning to the statesmen of the future not to repeat the policies that bore such bitter fruit in 1839-42. Today, Britain is trying to disentangle itself from its fourth Afghan war. Astonishingly, President Hamid Karzai turns out to be from the same tiny sub-tribe, the Popalzai, as Shah Shuja, while the Gilzai tribe who brought him down now make up the foot soldiers of the Taliban. The same tribal battles are being re-fought in the same cities 170 years later. Only the flags are different. There could be no clearer illustration of the famous dictum of Edmund Burke, that he who does not learn from history is fated eternally to repeat it.
The author William Dalrymple was closing his book of the week, Return of a King, The Battle for Afghanistan. It was read by Tim Piggott-Smith, abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. The Shipping Bulletin is next, and to take us there, it's sailing by. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday, the 2nd of February. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. New low expected 500 miles west of Iceland, 965, by 1800 Saturday. Low Denmark, 992, moving away southeastwards. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. West Viking, northerly 6 to gale 8, backing southerly 5 later.